My guest today is Michael Van Ewyk, who lives in Milton, not far from the studio. Actually, I think Michael walked here today. I know he did. Michael's had a jam-packed life as a volunteer for a small charity called Eyes for Africa. Now, it does work for poor people in Ethiopia who can't afford to see an ophthalmologist. Remember Fred Hollows? Well, there are other charities that do the same thing. We'll get back to that, as Michael has been living with a rare form of lymphoma as well, and raised funds for this cancer by riding his bicycle on a 700-kilometre ride in western New South Wales recently. So on behalf of Triple UFM, thanks for coming in today, Michael.
My pleasure. Yep, my pleasure.
No worries. Well, let's start off with telling the audience about how you were diagnosed with this rare form of lymphoma.
About 15 years ago, I was suffering from anemia, and because I had a pretty active life. I was cycling, I was bushwalking, and my GP couldn't work out what it was. And eventually, he got a call. We did some routine blood tests, and he got a call from the lab saying, oh, you better get him back in. There's a really strange reading here. And subsequent tests revealed that I had this very rare form of lymphoma called Waldenstrom macroglobulin anemia. Took me 6 months to learn how to say it. And it's a very rare cancer. About 5 per million get diagnosed each year. So there would be, we estimate no more than about 1,200-1,500 people in Australia that have got it.
How did you come to ride a charity ride to raise the funds?
Even though it's a very rare cancer, we've got a very active support group in Australia, and it's linked with the International Waldenstrom Foundation in America. Now, I'm on the committee, and this year, the Leukemia Foundation partnered with our organisation to raise, for a two-year project, to raise funds for research into Waldenstrom's, which is unusual that they would raise money for one specific rare cancer. So having learning that, I decided, I can do something. I'll put my hand up and said, look, I'll do a bike ride. I turned 70 this year, so I'll do a 700-kilometre bike ride, which I originally was going to do from Albury to Mildura along the Murray, but, of course, that got stopped by the border closure. So I then reworked another course from Balranal to Wagga and did it late October, early November, and finished on the 3rd of November.
How are the winds going across the plains there?
Well, it was all flat country. That's why I chose to ride in the Riverina. But the first 2 days was great. I had a westerly wind behind me both days, and I averaged a really good speed. I did 100 kilometres roughly each day. But, of course, after that, the winds were all over the place, so it became a little bit harder. But I still managed to average over 25 k's for the 700. And I did it over 9 days. So I had 2 days on, a day off, 2 days on, and then the last 3 days I did in one go. So, but it was good. I felt great at the end. And the best thing is I raised over $11,000. So I'm really pleased about that, yeah.
Did you have a backup crew? You must have.
I had my partner. We have a camper that sits on the back of our four-wheel drive. So she was behind me all the time. I had big signs on the back, one big one saying, caution, cyclist ahead. So she was always behind me, which was great because a few times we had to ride on really busy roads with trucks. The trucks would move right across. They knew there was a cyclist ahead. And I was actually very impressed with the way the truck drivers paid attention to that sign and really did avoid me because, you know, when a big truck goes past on a cycle, you get blown all over the place. So I was very impressed. And the 99% of the cars did the same thing. So, yeah, it was good. I felt quite safe. But most of the ride was on back roads. So no trucks, just basically the odd car.
What's the name of the charity?
It's a Leukemia Foundation, sorry. Leukemia Foundation of Australia, sorry.
Okay, so how would you donate to the charity if you wanted to donate some money?
Oh, well, you could just donate to the Leukemia Foundation, but you can't donate to my ride anymore because the donation page, which was through Everyday Hero, has now been closed. So, yeah, you can't actually donate to our project anymore. I mean, you can. There's if you go to the Leukemia Foundation, you can actually donate to the strategic plan to raise money for Waldenstrom's, but generally you can also donate to the Leukemia Foundation.
I have to ask you, we actually know each other. We've known each other through our children. You've had this terrible thing plaguing you for all these years. Is there some form of medicine that you've had to
take? Look, I've had a bit of a roller coaster with this. I initially, it's a very, what they call indolent disease. It's very slow growing. So I basically was able to put up with the symptoms for the first 6 years. And then I had a round of chemo, which gave me remission for about 12 months. And then things started to go backwards again. So we tried, my hematologist at the time, not the one I have now, but tried a couple of other chemos. One of them really knocked me around. I ended up with an anaphylactic reaction in the chair here in Milton, and they thought I wasn't going to even get out of the chair. So they decided that the chemos were too toxic for me. So I spent about 9 months with my hematologist. Really, there weren't that many alternatives, but I had met this hematologist, Professor Judith Trotman, at a conference the year before. She's based in Concord. So I got a referral to her, and when I turned up there, she was just starting a drug trial for a new drug for America called ibrutinib, and it's a protein blocker that blocks the protein in the malignant B cells in my bone, in my bloodstream. And I was the first in Australia on the trial, and I've never looked back. It's just been amazing. My blood levels are normal. My life is normal. I have normal red cell counts, so I can still do what I like this 700-kilometre bike ride.
Yeah, because that'd be pretty exhausting.
Oh, yeah. Look, these new targeted therapies coming out of the US and Europe are fantastic. They leave chemotherapy way behind, don't have the same side effects. The future looks good for people with lymphomas like this.
That's fantastic. We're going to come back to you in a second. I'm talking to Michael Van Nieuwenhuyck, and that's just what he's been putting up with for the last 15 years. Listen, we've been talking to Michael Van Nieuwenhuyck, and he's a volunteer in a couple of organisations. He's just explained about one of the ones that he's involved with, but the other one he's involved with is an organisation called Eyes for Africa. Michael, how did you come to be involved with the charity in Ethiopia? How did that come about?
It was serendipitous. I was listening to Radio National back in 2009, and I heard this interview with this woman called Julie Tyres talking about the charity that she started for free cataract operations in Ethiopia. And I was really impressed with her. She just sounded like, so matter of fact, like someone had gone down to Woolies to do the shopping. She just set up this charity. She'd been there on a holiday. She's an ophthalmic nurse, so she's very familiar with that side of things, in the medical side. And she realised, she could tell just being in the country, that there was an amazing amount of blindness there, preventable blindness from cataracts. So she felt she couldn't just ignore that fact. And so she came back, registered a charity. She was based in Melbourne at the time. She went over there, raised a bit of money from donors, and went over with her brother, who was a photographer. They organised with an ophthalmologist in Ethiopia, and they went to, I can't recall the village they went to, and did a set of free cataract operations. Now, she targets mainly rural areas where there are really poor Ethiopians who would never be able to afford eye care, and where the prevalence of cataracts is much higher. So I was so impressed that I actually found out the contact details, rang her up and said, look, I'm really impressed. You sounded fantastic. I'd really like to help, but I don't know what I could do. And so she said, well, what do you do? And I said, well, I'm a photographer and a graphic designer. And she said, oh, we've got nothing. We have no letterhead, no logo, nothing. So I set about designing all that sort of stuff. And gradually became involved with her, and she started to talk me into coming to Ethiopia as a photographer. So I first went over in early 2011, and since then I've been over six times to Ethiopia, yeah, over the years. The last time was 2017, was the last trip I went on. So, I ended up organising the non-medical side of these campaigns in Ethiopia. She would do the medical side, and I did all the logistics, finance, transport, everything, hiring and firing Ethiopians who we used over there. So, but the charity is basically run on donations and volunteers. So we take volunteers from here. generally nurses. We've taken the odd ophthalmic surgeon. We've had doctors go with us and anaesthetists. All pay their own way. No one gets paid. And the only people we pay are the Ethiopians that we employ at the various medical clinics and hospitals in these remote areas that we go to.
Do you get any assistance at all from the federal government?
None whatsoever. We don't get any from the Australian government. We don't get any from the New South Wales, from the Ethiopian government. We did apply for tax-free status, but we were knocked back. Supposedly we weren't big enough, like Fred Hollows. But I managed to get tax-free status for donations through the local Rotary group, Milton Ulladulla Rotary group. So we're one of their overseas projects. And so donations now get tax-free status. But we run purely on donations from private citizens.
How many people would be in the organisation, just roughly?
Well, for a good part of the time, it was Julie and I basically running it. But she now has a son-in-law, and there's been different people on the committee that runs the charity, but basically it's Julie from the word go, and now I'm still on the committee. I'm now the treasurer. Her son-in-law is a lawyer, so he looks after that side of things. His daughter she's a PR person. But basically it's a nucleus of at the most three or four people that run this charity. And we've gone over every year, and when I first started with them, we were doing month-long campaigns. So we would do 2 weeks in one remote area, and then we'd pack up and move to another remote area and do another 2 weeks. But for the last 2 years, we've just been going over for 2 weeks only, mainly because the logistics has become more and more difficult working in Ethiopia.
Look, Ethiopia really is a little bit of a cowboy place, isn't it? You say, well, they're really isolated areas and they're hard to get to, but you've had some very interesting experiences getting to these places and staying there trying to help people with their eyes.
Well, look, as I said, we go only to remote areas, and for a number of years we were working in the Afar region, which is in the northeast, which is a very, very inhospitable, dry desert region, mainly pastoralists, totally uneducated people, and no facilities whatsoever. We would hire a bus and a truck to carry all our gear and a small coaster bus to take us, the volunteers. And at a lot of places we had to just camp in tents. There was no hotel. A few places where there were hotels, they'd barely get one star. You know, you were lucky if your toilet worked. Getting a hot shower was a real potluck. And, yeah, food was very questionable in a lot of these places, so... Yeah, it was difficult, but that's where the need for the eye care was. We went to a number of places twice. We went to Dupti, a town in the Afar region. We went there 2 years in a row, and we ended up doing over 400 cataract operations in that area. So,
under those conditions?
Under those conditions, yeah. Look, we worked under extreme conditions. It was incredible, really, what Julie was able to organise. I was totally impressed with her and the way this place went.
What time of year did you go, mostly?
Tried to go in the Ethiopian winter, which isn't really a winter. It's unless you're up high. And Ethiopia is actually, people don't realise, but the average height is over 2,000 metres in Ethiopia because of the plateau. And I remember one location up in the Simien Mountains we went to was absolutely freezing. But other areas we went to, it was swelteringly hot, very humid. But we always tried to go around January, February, which is the Ethiopian winter, even though they didn't have a real winter, really, because it's quite not that far off the equator. Mm. So,
did you, the first time you went there, was it a bit of a shock to you, or had you travelled in places like that before?
Oh, I've been in a fair few third world countries, Nepal, Egypt, and stuff. So it didn't surprise me, but look, over the years, over the trips there, I saw unbelievable poverty. You couldn't imagine it. I was a keen cyclist, so I actually bought a bike, which I left with all our equipment. And I remember one place I was riding along the road. It was a trucking town, and there were people lying under these filthy blankets on the side of the road. They had nowhere else to sleep. And I'd have to weave around them. I couldn't believe that. sort of poverty. But, yeah, no, there's a high level of poverty in Ethiopia.
What was it like dealing with the Ethiopian officials then? Like when you went through, when you came into the airport and went through customs and all that?
I got a string of stories about customs problems. But, look, the initial problems were with the Ethiopian Open Government. We couldn't just go in there on a tourist visa. We had to have business visas for us and the volunteers to be able to work, to do actually charity work there. So we relied on the Ethiopian government and the consulate here in Canberra to provide the visas for us. And every year it got later and later that they would let them provide these visas. And eventually in 2017, the day we were booked to fly, the visas hadn't turned up. It was a total schmozzle. At the other end in Ethiopia, we had all constant problems. We would organise the year before what village or area we would go to, and we had to rely on the local health authorities to advertise the fact that we were coming to do these free cataract operations, because some people travelled incredible distances. There was one fellow in Afar, we found out he travelled 400 kilometres and turned up, and poor fellow, he had a condition that we couldn't treat, so he just turned around and did 400 kilometres back to his village. So we needed them to advertise the fact that we were coming, and there were a number of villages we went to over the years where we turned up and they said, "Who are you?" They didn't even know we were coming. And so there was no one waiting, and we had to ourselves drive around and try and find suitable patients with it. Was just, it was crazy. It was really hard to deal with them. So
when you were there, what conjures up in my mind is any help from the Australian government, the consulate there. Did you manage to get any help from them?
No, not at all. There is a consul, Australian consul in Addis Ababa, and we a couple of times have had contact with whoever it was at the time, but no, they don't have a lot of sway over the Ethiopian government, the consul there. I think it's more an honorary role. So
That explains it.
Yeah.
And coming back into Australia, of course, you were talking to me yesterday, we were having a coffee, and telling me you brought knickknacks back like you do when you come back from those places. How did Border Patrol how did they treat you?
Well, they even treated me like I was some sort of vermin, because of this lymphoma, I can't have the yellow fever vaccination because it's a live virus. And every time I've come back, they've pulled me aside, put me in a room, read me the riot act saying, you should have, let us know beforehand. I said, well, how can I? So I had to sign a document saying that if I get any kind of symptoms, to go straight to a GP, et cetera, et cetera. But also, if we brought any souvenirs back, they sort of went through our packs with a fine-tooth comb. Anything that looked a bit suspect, they would then take off and fumigate. My shoes kept getting doused in this chemical of whatever it was. I don't know what it was, because we had to admit that we were working in rural areas, so we were in farms and places like that. So.
And what about going into Ethiopia with the customs there? Was it sort of like nudge, nudge, wink, wink sort of thing, or was it like turn a blind eye or what?
Well, no, it was interesting. Customs in Ethiopia, they're a rule to their own, and we had, on occasions, we had a health official there to help us get through. He had no sway over the customs, and they tried to take everything from us that they thought could be resold. So we would bring in boxes of sunglasses because we provided patients with sunglasses after the cataract operation because their eyes are very susceptible to bright light. And on a number of occasions, we had our sunglasses confiscated. As far as I know, there's still a box of 400 sunglasses sitting in customs unless someone's already taken it. But we brought in a generator, and they have these incredible import duties. They wanted to charge us the full price of the generator, which was in Australian dollars, it was $1,900. They wanted to charge us $1,900 duty on it. And we got into a massive argument, and eventually someone who sort of sympathised with us in the customs department said, "Oh, is it secondhand?" And we went, "Oh, yeah, it's secondhand." And we ended up paying $200 US to get it in. But look, they took everything from us and tried to charge us duty on all sorts of stuff. My camera equipment, you know, they always pulled that out, said, "What, you know, what's this for? You're going to resell it?" And of course not, but, it was incredible difficulty working with them at different times.
And all those times you went back, you went through the same processes? And
mostly, yeah, customs was a real headache for us.
Yeah, you're a better man than me. I think you've got a lot more patience than what I'd have.
Julie's the one. She just, she wasn't going to let anyone stop her. So.
Well, it's been really good talking with you, Michael. We've been talking with Michael Van Ewyk about the volunteer work he's been involved in the last decade or two. And on behalf of Triple U, I'd like to thank you for your time today and wish you all the best in the future. I'd like to get you back if you've got any more to add to it in the next year or so. How about that?
Certainly. Thanks very much. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.